Lisboa,
Bruxelles,
Sofia,
Warszawa.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Hello and welcome to the Europeans podcast, the only podcast with this central mission. We want to talk about Europe and we don't want to bore our listeners to sleep. So here goes. I'm Dominic Kramer in Amsterdam and I've got my pal Wojciech Oleksiak in Warsaw down the line. Hi Wojciech, what's funny?
You're a pal. Thank you. It's nice to hear that.
Oh, yeah. I thought I'd step up our game. You're not just my colleague anymore. You're my pal.
I'm very glad to hear that. It sounds weirdly Australian to my non-native ear, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah, no, you've got a point. It does probably sound a bit weird coming out of my British mouth, but nice to be back. Yeah, and actually, I'm going to try and be more energetic this morning at the top of the show, because when I listened back to last week's episode, I thought I sounded pretty sick and tired, which I kind of was.
Holiday isn't good for you.
No, apparently not. But I'm going to try a bit harder to sound energetic and healthy today.
You sound better already.
Thank you.
Okay, so tell me what's coming up. I'm a bit in the dark when it comes to what we have prepared for today.
Really? Check the Google spreadsheet, Wojciech.
I was busy doing other stuff for us.
Fair enough. Well, later on in the show, our producer, Katz Laszlo, is dropping by for an interview with the writer, Robert Winder, to talk about three of Europe's rivers that he argues made Europe. Three rivers that all originated from the same geographical cradle in central Switzerland. Can you guess which three rivers Robert and Katz are going to be talking about, Wojciech?
Well, I think I have a sense, but if you could help me at this very early hour, that would be really very gracious.
Yeah, it wasn't a kind question. Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot. The three rivers are the Rhine, the Rhone, and the Po. It's a chat about how our landscapes define us as people and as Europeans. And I, for one, can't wait to hear it. But first, of course, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week. So it's time for that part in the show in which we rather randomly hand out the honour of who has had a good week and who has had a bad week in Europe this past week. Now, I mentioned last week that for our August episodes, we've decided to focus on some more diverting, light-hearted stories, seeing as it is officially cucumber season, even if geopolitics, genocidal leaders and climate change are not taking a break this summer. I got actually quite a bit of, I think, justified feedback from listeners online pointing out that my bad week last week about Danish pets being donated to this zoo in Denmark to be fed to predators was not as lighthearted as I'd promised.
I told you once we were recording, right?
Yeah, and you and the listeners are absolutely right. I'm sorry. So this week, I'm trying a bit harder, and I actually, you'll hear, maybe I've gone a bit too far in the other direction and chosen something that's too ridiculous.
Where's your balance, Dominic? Where's your balance?
Yeah, well, let's start with you, Wojciech. Who has had a good week?
This is a heavily caveated good week, but I'm giving a good week to the European alcohol drinking habits, which is great news, but my story starts with a bit of sad news.
Oh.
You ready?
Okay.
So apparently a few weeks ago, a local brewery in Germany decided to shut down its operations due to a steady decline in sales of alcoholic beer.
Ah, like what? So because of a decline in alcoholic drinking across the whole of Germany?
It's not only across the whole of Germany, it's across the whole of Western world, I would say. But we'll get to that later. It just seems like the days of a never-ending boom on the alcohol market are numbered. Also, I have to acknowledge that despite an ambiguous headline, this was one of the most funny and optimistic dives I took on behalf of the Europeans. So I can't wait to share all the great quotes and testimonies I found for you.
Oh, great. I'm excited.
So first, some serious data. Bear with me for a moment. To your question, across Europe and the US, alcohol consumption has been falling for years now. The pandemic was an anomaly. People who didn't have a few extra glasses out of boredom or anxiety can throw their stones now. But we're back on a clear downward trend. Can you guess which drink has suffered the biggest sales losses since 2020?
Well, if you say it's one drink, then it's likely to be one of the big ones. Is it beer?
It is beer, the golden beverage. It goes back 7,000 years to the territories of today's Iran and is deeply woven into European culture, but apparently it's sliding out of our drinking habits. Compared to the start of the millennium, the average German drinks 31% less beer today.
Wow.
And in the first half of this year alone, beer production in Germany fell by 6.3%. And that's not only in Germany. Poland is big for beer too. And brewers in my country reported a similar 6% year-on-year drop.
That's a big year-on-year drop.
Massive. And I'm only warming up. Belgium, another beer powerhouse, saw consumption fall by shocking 20% over the last decade. And, you know, we spoke of Germans and now Czechs, which are just synonymous with beer, you know, the inventors of Pilsner. Even Czechs are now consuming a bit less beer than they used to. And this continues across the alcohol board too. For example, in the UK, consumers aged 20 to 24 are nearly half as likely to spend their money on alcohol compared to their 75-year-old counterparts. Can you imagine that?
Gen Z, they're to blame, as always.
Good intuition.
Actually, they're healthy. No judgment, Gen Z.
Yeah. So basically, there's plenty of evidence that people born between the late 90s and early 2010s are driving a cultural revolution around alcohol. It's shaped by trends with wonderfully catchy names. So first up is the low no.
Yeah, we have a section in our supermarket, I think, that's like low no.
Oh, really?
Low alcohol or no alcohol, yeah.
Exactly. So basically, you know, Gen Zers, they prefer non-alcoholic substitutes for classic drinks. Alcohol-free beers are booming. Alcohol-free Prosecco is now a staple of, you know, every summer party. And personally, I'm a huge fan. 0% beers have basically changed the way I spend my summers. And what is your take on non-alcoholic beers?
Well, maybe I was born in the wrong generation and I should be a Gen Zer because I love alcohol-free beers. Actually, I particularly love low-alcohol beers. That's my real happy zone, a kind of like 1% beer. And I just think they always taste a bit better. And I like what I like about them is that you're not drinking something that tastes sweet. I know it does still have lots of sugar in it, but it's kind of like having that savory, refreshing beverage without having to drink a Coca-Cola.
Yeah, and without feeling groggy if you have more
exactly
than one or three. Yeah, and I have to say something that brought me a lot of joy, I think it was last month, it's on Reddit, I found a testimony or an ode rather, which struck a chord personally with me. I'll allow myself to quote my favorite part of it. Open quote. "This golden nectar has been my favorite drink ever since I first tasted it as a teenager. Back in my uni days, I drank beer with breakfast, lunch, dinner for hangovers, with a movie, or simply for no reason at all. Many years have passed and my taste hasn't changed one bit. But for the sake of both my professional and private life, I try to maintain at least a semblance of sobriety and clarity of thought. Which is why alcohol-free beer strikes me as the greatest invention of the past decade."
Wow. Bravo. I mean, I drank beer with breakfast. Oof.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think I maybe did that once or twice in my uni days.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I also have a long-standing relationship with beer. Anyway, you know, what emerges as the biggest movement pushing getting drunk further and further down the weekly to-do list of Gen Zers is something called Sober Curious Movement. Have you ever come across that?
No. Is that something with a hashtag.
Oh, definitely it is. Absolutely. So yeah, as an elderly TikTok vulture who only uses TikTok to spy on the younger generation, I searched hashtag sober curious and was lost for at least an hour. It's just absolutely fascinating. So I'm going to play you some snippets.
Oh, fun.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be fun. Here's one girl on her first sober New Year's Eve celebration.
And I still went out with my friends. I still partied. I was just drinking caffeinated sparkling water. And by 1 a.m., I was back home eating a steak and making a vision board for the new year.
Why was she eating steak at 1 a.m. in the morning?
I don't know. I have to say, I was like, the thing that spooked me the most was the creation of vision board at 1 a.m.
Yeah.
Like, you know, give yourself a break, girl.
And the caffeinated sparkling water. What is that?
I don't know. Maybe we're too old for that. Anyway, there's a notion of beauty influencers in the movement.
My face, my skin has never looked better. And my energy levels are so high, I feel I could run a marathon.
But also, a lot of these videos take mental health into serious consideration.
Really, what it came down to for me was I would get debilitating hangovers. I would feel so depressed, and I've had experienced depression before, and it was just, I knew it wasn't worth it.
And this is what I think is the major factor here. Gen Zers seem to be much more aware and open about their struggles with anxiety, social anxiety, and depression. And, you know, instead of self-medicating with alcohol, something almost all of my peers did, me included, they look for more sustainable ways to get better. Like, you know, they seek therapy or at least watch hours of mindfulness or sober curious content, which I think is way better than drinking. Also, I have to share one screenshot with you, not to make it all too rosy for Gen Z. Also on Reddit, I'm a Reddit dweller. This one is from the Netherlands, and the quote answers the question about whether rising prices of alcohol affect Gen Zers' decision to buy alcohol or not. Mm-hmm. And the answer reads, in the Netherlands, it is. Some say it's too expensive, they just drink water all night and have a pill.
When you're talking about pills, you're not talking about pills, no, the Czech invented beer, right? You're talking about little white things that you put in your mouth.
Yeah, white or pink, depending on the pill.
Yeah, I honestly know quite a lot of people who do that. And I always think, yeah, you are saving money.
Yeah, and maybe, perhaps, you're saving some of your health too, which is going to be a topic of a broader and like in detail discussion in one of our upcoming specials this autumn.
Yeah, presumably depending on which pill you're taking.
Very like heavily depending on which pill you're taking.
This is not the Europeans like advocating right now, go and take pills.
No, we're going to advocate for that in a few months, actually. spoiler okay. alert.
In case you have no idea what we're talking about here, which is probably most of you, we are making a mini series in the autumn, in October, called Who Does It Best, where we compare policies amongst different European countries. And Wojciech's making an episode about drugs policy, like trying to find the most effective drugs policies. So I think that's what you're referring to, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, basically, I just learned how harmful alcohol is throughout my research. Mm-hmm. And there is quite a bit of evidence that the pill might be actually better for you, but I'm not going to get into detail because, you know, this is coming up later. But yeah, basically, you know, it just seems like the Lono and Sober Curious movements are really spreading, and it's not good news for alcohol producers.
But it is good news for our livers.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so good week for German livers, but to play devil's advocate for a second, what does it mean for these alcohol producers? Like, are they going to have to retire and move on to selling pills?
That would be an unexpected pivot, but maybe. To be very honest with you, it is still a golden multi-billion euro industry. And, you know, the sad thing about it is that huge companies adapt just by ramping up production of 0% substitutes and aggressively advertising their products to the demographics that, you know, fancy getting smashed from time to time. But you're very right that there are players in the market that we can feel sorry for. And it's, you know, these smaller, often artisanal or family-run breweries, for example. The problem is that you produce alcoholic beer by removing alcohol at the very late stage of the production. And this pivot, like, you know, so, like, transform your production cycle to be able to do this, this is really costly. And not every company has €1 million. That's the estimate cost of such a pivot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If you're a small family-run brewery, you probably don't have €1 million in your family's stash. So you might remember that I started the story with a case of a German local brewery that had to close down, shut down their operations because of the dropping sales.
Oh, yeah. This was the bad news within this good week. Yeah.
Yeah. So they are on the losing end of this whole phenomenon. So basically, the sales were dropping, the costs are on the constant rise because of energy prices and water prices and everything. And, you know, a very hard decision had to be taken. They have withstood two world wars, but this trend just killed the company.
Oh, the Gen Z has killed them off.
They contributed vastly. It's not like the Gen Z, you know, on their own, but yeah. So, you know, it is what it is. Alcohol is really dangerous and has plagued our societies for centuries. It's responsible for an appalling number of deaths in Europe every year. According to the World Health Organization, 1 in 11 deaths in Europe every year is due to alcohol use. You might remember an episode from a few months back when our producer Katz told us how most recent research shows that any dose of alcohol is actually harmful. So I'm really happy to see this trend emerge at the end of the day. I just hope it's not a temporary fashion. I think it's great that Gen Z think a lot and out loud about their well-being. And if deciding against rampant alcohol consumption is the first step to get better, I cannot be happier.
Thank you, Gen Z.
Thank you, Gen Z. Okay, enough beer chat. Who has had a bad week, Dominic?
Well, last week we discussed the phenomenon of cucumber season. This week on the Europeans, I'm announcing that it is sausage season. And I'm giving bad week to the Bratwurst after a row ignited...
Sorry, what? Is it Oktoberfest or something? Beer and Bratwurst?
No, but it was International Bratwurst Day past weekend. Oh. So yeah, that's why it's coming up. But yeah, apologies in advance for this being a very German-heavy food and drink, good week, bad week. At least it's got like a dramaturgical through line. Yeah, so I'm giving bad week to the Bratwurst after a row reignited between two German states about which state can claim to have created this most beloved German culinary product.
Serious thing.
Yeah, all of this happened around a time which should have been a moment of celebration, World Bratwurst Day, which I'm sure you were all celebrating on August the 16th. I guess I should probably describe what the Bratwurst is for people who aren't aware or have never eaten one. Basically, the Bratwurst is an iconic German sausage, which is often served with mustard and in or with a white bread roll. It can be prepared and served in many different ways, depending on which state you are in. And I think it's fair to say that German society essentially runs on three pillars: manufacturing, techno music, and Bratwurst.
It is fair to say, indeed. Oh my God. Anyway, I'm really happy you're talking about German sausages again, seeing as the last time you mentioned the Currywurst, the Volkswagen Currywurst on the show. It went so viral on our Instagram. It basically blew up the internet.
It's true. Yeah, that video has been viewed on Instagram hundreds of thousands of times, which I find pretty random. And yeah, actually, just a little sidebar, because it went viral, I also got quite a bit of hate online, because that's what happens. Yeah. Mainly from Germans who are angry at me for describing the Currywurst as unhealthy. And yeah, maybe there are more unhealthy snacks out there, but I think some of these defensive Germans need to read up on processed meat.
Bunches thrown. Okay.
Yeah, but back to bad week before I create a diplomatic crisis for offending more Germans, although I should have mentioned that I am actually a German citizen myself. This week I wanted to discuss the feud between the state of Bavaria and the state of Thuringia. To be honest, the feud about who invented Bratwurst has been going on for decades, but the whole thing blew up again over the past week. And it's not just arguments between the two states, because actually in the past there have been arguments within Bavaria about which town first served Bratwurst. That one was seemingly settled, and the title is currently held by a restaurant in Regensburg, a place called Wurstkuchel, which claims to have the oldest bratwurst stand in the world. Although the Nurembergers point out that Wurstkuchel has actually changed location since it started, whereas Nuremberg's oldest bratwurst joint, not as old, but it is still in the same place. Am I getting too into the weeds?
I'm completely lost, but carry on.
Okay. Well, anyway, before I get carried away, Wojciech, if you had to guess, in which year do you think Wurstkuchel began serving bratwurst?
Bratwurst. It's not a very high-techy food. I would say it could be like medieval times, let's say 15th century.
They say it was back in the year 1378 that bratwurst began being prepared at their spot, which is a long time ago. And yeah, I find it kind of charming that they are still serving bratwurst there, even as someone who thinks we all need to stop eating meat. But the reason why I'm talking about this all today is because whilst some work was being done looking into the heritage of the famous Krämerbrücke or Krämer Bridge in Erfurt, a historian found a document that described a hut and a roasting pan being present on their bridge over 100 years before the Regensburg restaurant's first bratwurst was served in the year 1269.
Mm-hmm. This is getting weirder and weirder. Am I right to assume you're only talking about this because the bridge has the same name as your surname or something?
No, that's not why I'm talking about it. Although I actually have been to the Krämer Bridge.
Really?
Yeah, it's so beautiful. It's one of the few bridges in the world that has inhabited buildings on it. Like, and they're almost all artisanal shops and cafes with the owners of the shops living in the apartments above. So I actually really recommend a trip to Erfurt if you're in the area. I was there when my husband was working there for a few months. Krämer means small shop owner or small merchant, which is why Krämer Bridge is the bridge for the small shop owners. But yeah, I love Erfurt and I love the Krämer Bridge, not just because of my name.
Uh-huh. Okay. You're probably getting some royalties for every ticket sold. I don't think you're going to be an impartial judge here between Regensburg and Erfurt.
Well, it's true. I've not been to Regensburg, but I don't doubt that it also has its charms. And actually, when it comes to this bratwurst feud, I do feel a bit sorry for Regensburg, because in this historical document that was found that describes a roasting pan in a small hut on the Krämer Bridge in Erfurt, there is absolutely no mention of sausage.
What? So why is there even a debate right now then?
Well, Martin Sladacek, the World Heritage Project Manager who was involved with uncovering this document, says, even if it wasn't mentioned what the food was that was fried, quote, we know what people ate in the Middle Ages, sausages and fried meat.
Well, that's not a very rigorous scientific approach to my ears. And how has the restaurant in Regensburg responded to this claim then?
They're actually being quite blasé about it. They don't think it's such a big deal, which I think is fair enough.
Where's the feud then? It doesn't sound like one.
Oh, just you wait to hear what I've got coming. Honestly, I really fell into the rabbit hole about the origins of bratwurst, and it very quickly gets very confusing. Well, actually, it seems like you're already confused, aren't you, Wojciech?
I don't think I remember being more confused, to be honest, during any of the Good Week, Bad Week recordings.
Sorry. Well, someone who isn't confused is the owner of the German Bratwurst Museum in Mühlhausen. Yes, that exists. A guy called Thomas Meyer. He claims that the first written evidence of a bratwurst dates only to 1404. So much later than the Regensburg restaurant. And he says that was in Arnstadt, a town in Thuringia. So yeah, it's really confusing. And as for Erfurt's new claim, Thomas Meyer, this museum owner, says, I consider it very bold to conclude from this that bratwursts were cooked there. So, yeah, basically it's complicated, and the argument as to who deserves the crown of the oldest Bratwurst is definitely going to continue for many years to come. But this is where it starts getting really weird.
Can't wait.
Now, you remember I mentioned that Nuremberger's think that their restaurant is actually the oldest still running Bratwurst joint in Germany.
Yeah.
Well, they have used this moment with the historians in Erfurt reopening the argument to stake their claim once again. And the owner of the Nuremberg restaurant, Zum Golden Stern, a woman called Sophia Hillebrandt, has challenged Thomas Meyer, the owner of the Bratwurst Museum, to a boxing match to defend Nuremberg's Bratwurst history.
To a boxing match?
Yes. And a boxing match has been organized for the 26th of September at the museum in Mühlhausen.
So he agreed?
He agreed, yeah. And at this match, it will apparently be decided once and for all who has the oldest Bratwurst. Although I just don't understand why the other towns of like Erfurt and Regensburg haven't been invited to the fight. Why it's just between the museum owner and the owner of this restaurant that currently isn't described as the oldest restaurant. It's very weird.
I think they should just join, you know, sort of like professional wrestling style. They appear somewhere out of nowhere, then join the brawl, and then it's decided at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's actually a good idea. And honestly, maybe it is going to be more in the style of that kind of theatrical WWF fighting, because it seems the museum owner, Thomas Meyer, and the Nuremberg restaurant owner, Sophia Hillebrandt, aren't going to be fighting themselves. They're going to find proxies, apparently. And I think it's essentially all a publicity stunt, a trap to get foolish podcasters like me to talk about it. And here I am falling into that trap. But I just find it odd and kind of fascinating that this is all happening at all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious who the proxies are going to be. Is it going to be like a real fight when someone's going to like knock out somebody and it's going to be decided like that? Or is it going to be this theatrical, you know, WWF thing?
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye out. Maybe we need a special episode.
Okay, so the last question I would have for today is, what's the point of all this? Like, does it really matter who has the oldest Bratwurst? Like, isn't it more important who is currently producing the best or tastiest or healthiest Bratwurst?
Thank you for being the voice of reason, Wojciech. You're absolutely right. And actually,
you're welcome.
The nice thing about the German Bratwurst is that there are all these regional differences to how they are prepared. In Nuremberg, the Bratwurst is small and thin, often served with sauerkraut. In Thuringia, it's longer and fatter. The Fränkische Bratwurst is also relatively long and often made with marjoram. So there are all these different types, and some of the regional Bratwurst even have that protected geographical indication thing that the EU hands out to certain regional products, which connects the name of the product and its specific characteristics to the region. Anyway, all of this Bratwurst fighting may be a distraction from the fact that the long-term trends for Bratwurst look quite similar to the long-term trends for alcohol drinking in Germany. Consumption of pork amongst Germans has been decreasing in Germany steadily over the past decade.
No way.
Yeah, something which I would argue is a pretty good thing for the environment. But yeah, not such a good thing for Bratwurst restaurant owners. So maybe that's why they're trying to drum up some attention with this maybe slightly manufactured feud.
German culture is falling into pieces.
Yeah, apparently. They'll be coming for the techno next. Anyway, with that in mind, I am giving bad week to the Bratwurst. And with this, I promise we are going to stop talking about German food and drink. I think we've done enough for this year. This is actually kind of becoming a food podcast, accidentally.
It kind of is, but hey, cucumber season, cucumber is food, so
that's true.
We're justified here. This is the part of the show we internally call the begging segment or the Patreon worshipping segment. Why? Because none of this would be possible without a big group of wonderful people who choose to give us a few euros each month in the hope that we will tell them something valuable about Europe every week. And yes, it sounds like a cliche. I know it sounds boring, but it really isn't. Your donations aren't just a fundamental part of our budget today, they are the foundation of our entire long-term strategy. Let me explain that for a second. This year, we've joined an EU-funded radio network, which means we've got several months of a steady grant ahead of us. But the purpose of the grant is to help us reach the point where we're self-sustainable and able to fly on our own in under 15 months. However, since joining the network, donations have stagnated a bit, even as our listener numbers keep growing. Which, honestly, I understand that. We're no longer threatening you in this segment to disappear next week if you don't chip in. But to become truly sustainable, we still need a much larger group of people supporting us financially, roughly 200% more, or around 1,500 active supporters more. And that's a lot. And we know it. We're working on it every day. So if you'd like to see this scrappy little indie project continue for the long term, please consider giving us as little as €3 a month. That's like half of what you'd have to pay for a loaf of a sourdough bread, right, Dominic?
Well, yeah, in Amsterdam anyway.
And did we have any new supporters last week?
Yes, but to your point about stagnation, it was only two people. This is why we want to give our big, big thanks to Moicha and Claudia, our two newest supporters. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Moicha. Thank you, Claudia. We really appreciate it. If you want to be like them, please go to patreon.com/Europeans podcast and consider supporting the show. We'll leave a link for you everywhere so that you can find it easily. Thank you.
So it's time for our interview segment. And this week we're joined by producer Kat Laszlo. Hi, Kat.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Nice you could join us. Before we go any further, I should mention that this is the segment of the show that is made in collaboration with our partners at Euronet Plus. You're going to talk to us today about some European rivers, I think.
I am, yeah. So I had the great pleasure of going to London to speak with Robert Winder, who is a British author and editor who's written a variety of books with quite different subjects. He wrote about the history of migration to Britain. He wrote about cricket. He wrote another book about how the lack of wolves has made the wool industry possible in England and how that shaped Englishness. I'm quite intrigued about that one. But most recently, he wrote another book about how three major rivers, all originating from the same patch of glaciers in Switzerland, have shaped the history and economies and culture of Europe. Those rivers are the Rhone, the Rhine, and the Po. And I thought it was really interesting to look at how geography has shaped our continent. So I hope you enjoy the chat we had as well. Well, first of all, hello. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, a live interview, very rare for us. We often do a lot of video calling, so it's fun to see someone in person. You have just written a book. Tell me what the title is.
Well, it's called Three Rivers, and the notion really came from many trips to Switzerland for leisure and holidays, really, and noticing that the three great river systems of Europe, the Rhine, the Rhone, and the Po via the Ticino. The Ticino, they all rise off the same mountain just near Andermatt in Switzerland. I thought, my goodness me, the more I thought about it, I thought you've got the whole French civilization of the Rhone, the whole Italian civilization of the Ticino and the Po, which flows down through Lake Maggiore and all the way along Lombardy to Venice. You've got the whole of German civilization up and down the Rhine, and Dutch indeed. So I just thought how momentous it is that all of this cultural weight of European history, it depended on which side of the mountain ridge the rain happened to fall. The kicker being, of course, that when you go there and you look at where the glaciers used to be and where they now are, you realize that the glaciers on top of those rivers, which are the tap or water tank of the whole system, are, of course, vanishing at a terrible rate. And so it felt urgent just to write a kind of thank you letter to those rivers.
And you also wrote a book in the past about exploring Englishness and the history of Englishness through the landscape. Why did you choose that frame?
Well, I mean, I'm not the only person to think that geography is essentially, is the kind of fundamental formative influence on these things. History, it has been said, is really just the kind of workings of geography over time. And in that book that I wrote a few years ago, The Last Wolf, that was based on the idea that England's medieval supremacy came from the fact that it had no wolves. Everywhere else in Europe was wolf-haunted, and therefore you couldn't have huge flocks of sheep. And since England also had a tremendous amount of rain and lovely grass, we had perfect conditions for sheep. So we had vast sheep estates, a lot of the monasteries, in fact, who'd come from France and Italy. So you had these vast sheep estates of 14,000, 18,000 sheep. And merchants would come from the Low Countries, from Flanders, from Italy, from Spain, and from France to buy our wool. And so for several hundred years, England, before it was Britain, was sort of the medieval equivalent of an oil state, really. That was the basis of England's wealth, and that went into the decor of the landscape today, the castles, the cathedrals, the towns, the villages. And it also gave rise to the legal systems and the financial systems and the markets and the trading networks. So that simple geographical fact of being an island without wolves.
Was it always without wolves, or did we just kill them all?
We killed them all, and we pushed them actually out into the further reaches of kind of Scotland and Wales, and, you know, but they were pretty much ethnically cleansed out of England. But there weren't that many, I guess, being an island, in the same way that there are hardly any snakes in the island of Ireland. England was just happily free. It just had this one geographical advantage.
Okay, so just as a reminder, you tell the stories of the Rhine, the Rhone, and the Ticino, which flows into the Po. What would you say is the most important feature of each of those rivers, and what do we have to learn from them about Europe?
Gosh,
that's basically your whole book, but here we go.
I'll try and summarise it in not more than 30 seconds. I suppose my great discovery was that the Rhone was the route through which three extraordinary things entered France: ancient Rome, Christianity, and wine. And you can't really imagine France without any of those things. And I suppose they're best summed up in the great vineyards of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, where the popes from Italy had their palaces in the 14th century. And so the whole of that southern French culture came up the Rhone. In the case of the Rhine, it was really an incredible engine or machine, much more vividly than I had ever understood as I journeyed up and down it, for producing war, really, war and conflict. And that was because France always felt the Rhine was its outer edge, its rampart in the east, its wall against the German world, whereas Germany always wanted all of it. It felt it was its central arterial nervous system, and it wanted all of it, Papa Rhine. It was its cultural center. And so there's, for 1,000 years since the time of Charlemagne and after, endless wars up and down the Rhine. And it's kind of tragic in a way to visit it. You probably know it better than me, particularly in the arena of Holland and the consciousness of the Rhine, of this enormous ribbon of water flowing right through the country. But as you journey up and down, of course, all the cities were flattened during the war, during several wars. But really, for 1,000 years, wars have ranged over there, from Louis XIV in France, the 30 Years' War. 30 years, a long time for a war to last. And then there was the 7 Years' War and the 9 Years' War. I'm sure there was an 8 Years' War somewhere that I haven't noticed, but the endless wars up and down the Rhine. In the case of Italy, rather different, because the Ticino is this lovely, bright river flowing out of the Alps past Milan, and then it joins into the Po, and together they march on, and you have this most spectacular necklace of northern Italian cities, which, of course, for a long time were under Austro-Hungarian rule. And so they're this beautiful hybrid of Northern Europe and Italian Mediterranean Europe. And you have Milan, and you have all the other cities, Piacenza, Cremona, Padua. They're all rather set back from the river because it's such a flat, low-lying, hot river. You couldn't really build near it. But that gives rise to some of the nicest stories in the book, really, which is in Milan. It's about 10 miles back from the river because it was at risk of flooding. And so in the very early days of the Renaissance, they decided they needed connections with the river to trade with Venice and the Adriatic and the rest of Europe. And of course, the person they appointed to build their canal system was Leonardo da Vinci. And you can still walk along bits of the canals in Milan built by Leonardo.
You mentioned earlier that all of these rivers obviously start at the glaciers. These glaciers are rapidly disappearing. Given how important these rivers have been in shaping Europe, what do you think happens when the glaciers disappear?
Are we doomed? Are they doomed? Well, in a way, they've probably done their major work. They've carved out the great valleys in which are the cities, the cathedrals, the universities. They've done that already. And of course, they have 1,000 tributaries. They're not only dependent on the glaciers on the roof. But they are still very dependent on those because those glaciers continue to act as thermostats. In hot weather, they release more water, which keeps the rivers full at a time when the rainfall is low. And in very cold weather, they conserve water and prevent it from flooding down. What we're detecting now, and it's become an annual summer event, not just glacial collapses, but actually river floodings. I mean, I don't remember in my youth it being an annual event, terrible rivers overflowing and carrying cars into walls. Now it seems to happen every summer quite reliably. And I think it's just one of those, a bit more than a canary in the coal mine, it's just part of the destabilizing of the natural balance that the glaciers were part of. So there's an ecosystem of water, which is rain, glacier, river, ocean, and it's part of that great hydrological cycle that you need a meteorologist to really describe better for you than I can. But I was very aware looking at them that it was if you remove one strut of a circle, it's hard to predict what will happen and not much good.
Looking in the other direction, rivers have a way of forcing us to work together. And they're also constantly changing, and I'm wondering how you think these rivers can move us towards a more positive future in a time of great conflict now.
When you have huge new populations quarrelling over the same water supply, it's possible to imagine the same conflicts over water that we've had in recent times, over oil, for example, or other raw materials that are valuable. Along with that goes, as we've said, the possibility of compromise. And I think what the rivers ended up holding out to me was two things. And you see it clearly in the history of Europe. You know, for 1,000 years, Europe has wanted, because of these rivers and the rules and the ways of life laid down by these rivers, which in the end are quite similar, despite the local variations and differences, Europe has had a tremendous aspiration towards coming together in unity. I discovered during writing of the book that, you know, in Charlemagne's time, in the 8th century, his part of Europe, which was most of Western Europe, had a single currency, the Carolingian pound. Now, that's an idea whose time had not yet come, because it's repeatedly interrupted, that urge to unify. It's cut across by the urge to disintegrate. And those two impulses have been constantly rubbing up against each other and probably will continue. We can hardly imagine that we're going to put an end to what's been such a long-abiding thing. But I think what the rivers, they exist in literature and in poetry and in philosophy as images of continuity, and they've continued to roll along, and reliability. And so the endangering of them by glacial retreat puts all that into quite a sharp focus. But a river is still a very powerful image of tranquility, continuity, and kind of a reassuring thing. People like living beside rivers because it keeps bubbling along. Wherever you go, really, up and down these rivers, you know, you can lift up any little stone and wet stone, and, you know, in the trickle of water, you know, there's some emphatic story of European culture. So that's just the richness of Europe, really.
Thanks very much to Robert Winder for a conversation that meandered through climate change, the delights of traveling, war, trade, the whole shebang. The book is called Three Rivers, The Extraordinary Waterways That Made Europe, and you can find it in bookstores all across Europe or online starting August 28th.
time for some Inspiration Station. So this is the part of the show where we talk about some cultural things that we've been enjoying from Europe over the past week. What would you like to talk about this week, Wojciech?
Yeah, so last week I got a slap on the wrist for recommending an American book, and this week I should get a slap on the wrist for not really having consumed any cultural goods. I was so slammed at work with this show that I just had no time. I barely had the time to hop on the bike once. That's how my Maslow's hierarchy of needs looks like. Sorry.
Well, you're kind of forgiven because I know how much work you've been doing.
Yeah, there's been some complications. Anyway, in this case, I'm super happy to recommend you a film that has stayed with me despite the fact that I saw it quite a while ago. And it's titled The Guilty, and it's by Danish director Gustav Müller. Did you have a chance to see it?
No, I didn't. I don't know about it.
So I don't like teasing films with even mild spoilers. So what I can tell you is that the movie starts really slowly and it gradually turns into a complete nail biter, even though all the action takes place in a dark basement of a 112 call center. And, you know, watching it feels like eavesdropping on all these calls, and there's a lot to piece together on your own. And I think that is what makes the whole experience so gripping. It's truly fantastic. Mm-hmm. In all honesty, I can't understand why this movie didn't become an instant classic. It's as good as it gets when it comes to the European art house action cinema. I think there is this like subgenre of European art house cinema. One warning though, there's an American version of the film starring Jake Gyllenhaal that I haven't seen, so I can't promise it's anything like the original. And by the way, I'd be very tempted to understand one day why it requires producing a whole remake for a European movie to become a blockbuster in the US, right? Because it might be about the marketing power of Hollywood movie stars, but I'll be overjoyed to hear about it in detail from someone who knows more about that. Maybe it's an idea for an interview.
Yeah, that would be really interesting because there are so many European series and films that get remade in the States, and it kind of feels like, come on, is this really necessary?
Yeah.
But I think I heard about the Jake Gyllenhaal remake. I think that's why it's ringing a bell. I want to watch the original, though.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. Well, anyway, what have you been enjoying, Dominic?
Well, as well as reading a lot of books on holiday, which I mentioned last week, I also got back into listening to audiobooks. And I honestly feel a bit wary about recommending audiobooks on this podcast because I feel like, at least in my life, when I get into listening to audiobooks, I just stop listening to podcasts completely.
It's so true.
So I am only recommending this if you all promise you'll keep listening to us, okay? But yeah, I wanted to recommend two audiobooks that I've listened to over the past month, both in the same series. And I'm a bit embarrassed to recommend them because they're also not incredibly current. They're two incredibly well-known books that probably a good chunk of listeners have already read. I'm talking about two books from the Irish writer Colm Tobin. The first one is Brooklyn, which was written back in 2009, and the more recent follow-up, Long Island, was published last year. Brooklyn was made into a film a while back, starring Saoirse Ronan. Did you see it?
Yeah, it's a fantastic one.
I didn't actually see the film either. So this was my first entrance into the intellectual property. And Saoirse also narrates the audiobook. And she is just so good. She's got such a beautiful voice. And I find audiobooks can be quite hit or miss depending on the narrator. I often get like quite easily irritated if a performance is overdone or if they overdo the different voices of the different characters. But not with Saoirse. She brings the story and the character of Eilish Lacey, who she also played on film, to life with such a gentle and engaging tone. The novel follows a young Irish woman who's persuaded to move away from Ireland to go to Brooklyn across the other side of the Atlantic for better work opportunities. And it's such a wonderful story, and it's no surprise it made the Guardian's list of the 100 best books of the century so far. The follow-up, Long Island, is set 20 years later, and I have to say I was really disappointed to see that Saoirse didn't read it, but it is read by another wonderful Oscar-nominated Irish actress Jessie Buckley. And I actually also really loved her reading style. And I actually think the second book is even better than the first. So if you haven't read either of them, I'm envious of you because you've got them ahead of you and they're such a treat. If you have read them, why not try the audiobooks? I've got a happy ending for you to close off today's show from Helsinki. This month, data was released that shows that there has not been a single traffic-related death in the Finnish capital over the whole of the past year. Yeah, it's really amazing news and an excellent achievement for Helsinki, which has really invested in measures to try and bring down the number of traffic accidents. According to Politico, the EU is paying close attention to what the city has done to reach this happy milestone, because the EU actually has its own long-term goal called Vision Zero, which aims for as close as possible to zero fatalities in road transport by 2050.
Amazing. I remember when I toured Sweden many years ago as a musician, they told me that there were like two fatalities in a whole year preceding the year that I went there. So wow. That was really, that made a big impression on me coming from Poland, where, you know, the numbers are absolutely appalling. So can you tell me, what did Helsinki actually do to achieve that?
Yeah, they did a few things. They lowered the speed limit for cars to 30 kilometers per hour in most of the city center and in residential areas. And I think key to that was that it was then enforced with 70 new speed cameras and a new policing strategy that includes really quite steep fines, especially if you exceed the speed limit by quite a large amount. But they also do some more out-of-the-box things that I read about in an article in Bloomberg from a few years ago, which I'll link to in the show notes. For example, they apparently deliberately narrowed some streets and planted trees and bushes to make drivers feel like they have to drive slower. I just find it all quite impressive, especially considering the fact that it's quite an icy and dark city for a lot of the year. So well done, Helsinki. Congratulations. Let's hope all the other European cities can learn from this success.
Congratulations.
That's it for this week. We'll be back in your ears in 2 weeks. Wojciech, you're off to Kosovo next week, I think.
Oh yeah, super excited to visit. Yeah. I've never been.
I've never been either. I can't wait to hear all about it when you're back. And meanwhile, the rest of us are going to be busy working on different projects on this Who Does It Best series that we mentioned and lots more. In the meantime, if you miss us, you can catch us on the socials. A special shout out to everyone to please go and subscribe to us on YouTube. It would really help us with the algorithm. And just like as many videos as possible, even if you've already listened to our episodes. It's growing there slowly, but Wojciech's doing a lot of work over there and we'd really like it to pay off. You can also find us on Instagram, Mastodon and Blue Sky.
This week's episode was produced by Morgan Childs, Kaz Laszlo produced the interview, I did some mixing and mastering, and it was hosted by me and Dominic Kramer.
It was a group effort. See you all in 2 weeks.
See you all in 2 weeks.
Servus.
Tschüss.